This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, the midterm elections are coming sooner than you think. Can the Democrats avert disaster? Also, Republicans and Democrats spin a new report about Obamacare and jobs. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, Roseanne Cash joins us to talk about her new album, The River and the Thread. And then we say goodbye to the astounding actor, Philip Seymour Hoffman.
I've spent the past 3 years learning Finnish, which should come in handy here in Virginia, and I'm never ever sick at sea. So I want to know why I'm not going to be your Helsinki station chief.
Your course.
Excuse me.
We'll start with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. Can Republicans take back the Senate in 2014? They need to capture 6 Democratic seats, and it's looking more and more likely every day. How could the Democrats turn a bad midterm election season around? Then, a new report says Obamacare will reduce employment by 2.5 million jobs. Does that mean the Affordable Care Act is a job killer? Joining me in Washington is Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And from New Haven, Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
The 2014 midterm elections are 9 months away, and they are shaping up to be a bloodbath for Democrats. Democrats need to gain 17 seats to recapture the House of Representatives from the Republicans. Nobody thinks that this can happen unless perhaps every single Republican member of Congress has every single bridge in America blocked and causes traffic jams in every single district in America that can be directly blamed on Republican members of Congress. Only then could Democrats possibly capture the House. At the same time, the Senate is also in danger for the Democrats. They now hold a 5-seat majority. There are strong indications that they may not be able to hold that majority, that they may lose the 6 seats that would flip control of the Senate over to Republicans. John, let's very quickly, without getting into some of the
issues. Oh, don't you very
stop
quickly
it.
Me.
We're going to very quickly run through
don't
the
you
Senate,
mention a single
the vulnerable
proper noun.
Senate seats. You know, maybe we'll just have Emily do it. If
well,
you won't
no.
do it quickly, Emily will do it. So
well,
what are the vulnerable Senate seats and why? Very
well,
quickly.
No,
one,
no, no, no,
West
no,
Virginia.
No, no. There's a few more like big numbers you want to give before you give the low numbers. I think you want to say that in the 6th year of a president's term, since the Second World War, his party has lost 5.6 seats in the Senate, so almost the number that Republicans would need to take it over again. And in the House, it's upwards of 20. It's like 24. That the president's team has lost. So you have this historical situation, and
those
why
averages,
does that happen? Those
yes,
averages. The reason this often happens is that people use the House and Senate races as a way to punish the guy who's been in office, who they have, you know, negative feelings about. And also, just to your point about the House, Democrats would need to take 17 seats to take over the control of the House. And the number of actual toss-up races is like 15.
And then obviously the other big problem is that when you look at the senators who are up for election or the seats that are up for election this year, most of the vulnerable seats are in red states, right? They're held by Democrats in red states, or they are held by nobody. They're open in red states or states that lean red. And so it just seems like right off the bat, the Democrats are at a pretty major disadvantage.
And one more thing is that this is a midterm election, which means the electorate tends to be much smaller, and it leans more Republican. It's like more regular voters who tend to be older, whiter.
Fewer young people, fewer immigrants.
Yeah, that's the crucial point, is that the Democratic coalition, which is young and immigrants, they don't turn out in the midterm elections historically.
And these senators who were vulnerable were elected. Many of them were elected in 2008, a banner year for Democrats. And so they won seats in places they probably wouldn't have won at other times, and so now they're vulnerable as their 6-year cycle comes due.
Like Kay Hagan in North Carolina.
And another big, just sort of top-line number before we get into the individual places, if we ever do, is that increasingly over the last 20 to 30 years, states have voted for Senate in line with the way they voted for president. And so in the past, you could have a state that voted for a Democratic presidential candidate but had Republican senators and vice versa. That is no longer as much the case. And so if you look at 7 of the seats that are in contention here, they all were states that Romney won. In six of those states, he won them by those states by double digits. And so that just gives you some sense of the redness of the states in which these Democrats are running. And the president's approval rating, which is not in awesome shape nationally, is in even worse shape in these specific states.
Right. And so in South Dakota, there's a retiring Democratic senator, very red state fundamentally.
Right. That's gone.
That's gone. In West Virginia, retiring, many termed Jay Rockefeller, that state, which used to be historically very Democratic, is now extremely Republican and very anti-Obama. That seat is gone to Republicans. Montana, that's gone. And then you have the ones that are possibly less gone, where you have in Arkansas, you have an incumbent Democratic senator who's running for election, very charismatic, promising conservative challenger in Tom Cotton, in a state that has again moved very far to the right. So that seems like that seat is hard to hold. Seems like the Louisiana seat, which Mary Landrieu holds, has got good Republican challengers there. That's another one that will be hard to hold. And then in Alaska, Mark Begich, who's a Democrat in a very Republican state, who barely won that seat to begin with, probably will have a very hard time holding that. And then in North Carolina, Kay Hagan, a Democrat, probably is in the best shape of the seven. But again, that's a pretty red state and seems like she would be lucky to win it.
So we just wrote an obituary for
that's
all
seven,
those people.
Right.
And well, we'll dial it back in a second. I think the one thing I would say that's just a tiny little dynamic here that's different than in the previous races we've seen. In all those races we talked about, there was not one except for Alaska where there is a potential for a debilitating Republican internal fight. If you look at 2012 and 2010, in 2010, there were 10 toss-up states. Democrats held 8 of them. In 2012, there were 7. Democrats held 5. That was in large measure because they ran great races and also because you had the Christine O'Donnells, the Todd Akins, Sharon Angle in Nevada, Ken Buck in Colorado, the product of primaries where Tea Party candidates were nominated who couldn't run in the general. You don't have that in any of these cases with the exception of Alaska. Tom Cotton is a perfect example in Arkansas, who is, as David well described him, is a sturdy, stout. Democrats will try to paint him as all kinds of things, but he is not in the category of these other kinds of Republicans who have lost races where it should have been basically the Republican. It was the Republicans to lose, and they did lose it. That's not the case now in Arkansas.
So, Emily, it seems like the Democratic strategy in 2010 and 2012, in some sense, was just sit back and wait for Republicans to say some stupid thing about women and then win. It doesn't feel like in this cycle that Republicans are going to be stupid enough to do that. I feel like they're going to stay away, particularly from the dumb women things that they've put their foot in the mouth over that they may not do
at this time. I think you're more confident about that than I am, but maybe these candidates will be more disciplined. And I mean, we've just laid out such a handicap for Democrats that maybe the specifics of the campaigns won't even matter that much. But one thing I'm really interested in is how this attack on Obamacare plays out, because even if Obamacare is still looking relatively unpopular in these states, do people really think that repealing it is the way to go? And will the Republicans be able to just bash the Democrats and the president with the problems in Obamacare without offering any kind of real comprehensive solution for health care? Yes, probably they will.
Yes, they will. Yeah. I think they will. One of the reasons why they will is that the Democrats don't have anything to offer. That is what's so striking to me about these Democratic Senate candidates. You know, the incumbent senators seem pretty competent and they're smart people. They don't have an agenda. They're not willing to stand up and run in defending Obamacare. They're not willing to align themselves with the president. All they're doing is kind of trying to hold on.
I don't think that's entirely true. Some of them are defending Obamacare.
What's the positive agenda? No one's defending Obamacare with any kind of emphasis.
Well, the positive agenda, I'm not sure how much it's out there, but it's raising the minimum wage, reducing inequality, improving opportunity, making it easier for people to pay for college, and expanding pre-K.
Right. Yeah. I think they all are trying to do exactly what you're saying.
I mean,
Emily.
Maybe, David, what is really missing is a way to tie up all of those pieces of the package in a way that's really compelling and arresting and feels like a big solution to the country's problems.
And for these specific races, solution is less important than using those as tools to lift the protective shell of your opponent and get to his soft spot. So you use minimum wage and long-term unemployment and pre-K as a way to get to the idea that these are heartless Republicans who don't care about regular people. You know, the race is to get as many of your people as you can to get animated by that existing prejudice they have about the other side, or the people who are in the middle, as few as there are in these midterm elections. How do you get them to think of the other guy as a heartless Republican? And the vice versa, right? Of course, the Republicans with Obamacare are doing, how do you get Senator Pryor to look like a big government, meddlesome guy who meddled with Obamacare? Now he's going to meddle with EPA regulations. Then he's going to meddle with this, that, and the other thing, and that's going to crush your small business. So those individual ideas about income inequality, it's important to get solutions, and there are some voters who obviously care about that, but their greater power is as weaponry to pin the other guy down.
So do you guys think that this Democratic framing that you've just laid out, which I think both of you laid out more cogently and persuasively than I've heard candidates lay it out, do you think that that actually has the potential to engage voters, to get voters to turn out and to flip what appears to be a bad year towards the Democrats?
The problem is turnout, right? I mean, if I thought that young people and immigrants and African Americans in droves would come out as they did in 2008 and 2012, then I would feel a lot more optimistic on behalf of the Democrats. But if they don't come, then it doesn't really matter how much of a rallying cry this message would be for them, because they don't show up, then they have no voice.
I think you need white hot issues. And I think those are the ones we've all known. You know, their issues of contraception and women's health and choices and their abortion and their those kinds of things.
I wonder if the Supreme Court will help.
No.
Well, no, because what if they say that, you know, what if they uphold these religious objections to the contraception mandate? Will that seem to people like, OK, this is pretty conservative and we don't want this? Or will that feel like still it's just sort of nibbling around the edges of Obamacare and it doesn't really matter?
I think what the courts do is they tee up an unpredictable set of discussions about these possibly radioactive issues, and then candidates have to react to them. If these become flypaper issues and these candidates can't resist saying something stupid on the left or the right in response to a Supreme Court decision, then you have something that can be used in commercials and driven home with an important part of your constituency. I think the Wendy Davis race in Texas, I don't think she's going to be the next governor of Texas, but she is a magnet for people to say stupid things about women and reproductive rights and contraception. So whenever she does something, a lot of people feel need to comment. And anytime they do, there's an opportunity for, you know, them to embrace and inhabit the stereotype. And so I think the court could play that kind of a role in just providing a challenge that can upend a candidate.
That's a really useful way to frame it.
Do you think that on the right, the Obamacare issue is going to remain white hot, that it will animate voters the way that Tea Partydom did in 2010?
I think the Obamacare issue will be big for a couple of reasons. That button, you just graze it and it works, which is to say that it's not just about healthcare. It's about meddling in my life. It's about telling me what to do. It gets at a lot of kind of core anger and disappointment with this president and government and busybodies and know-it-alls. And those are strong emotions. And also, of all the things on the table, it's their best option.
Coming up, Republicans seize on a new report that says Obamacare will eliminate jobs. You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political Gabfest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. A Congressional Budget Office report on Obamacare this week delighted Republicans rooting for the law's failure. The CBO found that Obamacare would reduce employment in the U.S. by the equivalent of 2.5 million jobs, a number that Republicans jumped on immediately as devastating and job-crippling. Crippling to the economy. We're taking work away from people. Emily, does this number mean what it says it does? Of course it doesn't. Tell us why.
Well, what's disappearing are the number of work hours that add up to 2 million full-time jobs, right? So it seems like really what the CBO was talking about was a lot of people reducing their hours because they no longer have to get over a 20 or 30 hour a week or 40 hour a week threshold to qualify for health insurance, as opposed to businesses cutting jobs because of the costs of providing health insurance through the employer mandate. To me, those are two really different things. And what I kept thinking in the hand-wringing over the loss of all of these work hours is all the other hand-wringing we do about how people work too hard in this country and how desperate everyone is to work less hard. Also, what about all those long-term unemployed people who can't find any jobs? I mean, if one of the solutions for that is spreading around hours of employment more so that you can bring in more workers who aren't necessarily killing themselves to work every hour of the day. So if this really is about people choosing to work fewer hours as opposed to businesses cutting back, then it seems like that's a very different issue that we're talking about.
The equivalent hour metric used in this report, it's used in healthcare numerology or in healthcare analysis to try to come up with a central way to characterize what happens when you have a bunch of different workers who work different kinds of hours and how you think about your benefits as they spread out across those workers. But when it was used in the report, people kind of elided or skipped over the word equivalent, some of them in our profession, and thought, oh, this is 2 million jobs growing to 2.5 million jobs. And then that's what they reported. And then there were people, of course, who did that for political purposes and said this is going to be a bigger job killer. That estimate, by the way, is three times greater than the previous one the Congressional Budget Office made about the worker hour impact. Paul Ryan, to his credit, started the Budget Committee hearing in which he questioned CBO Director Elmendorf and said, okay, it's not about losing jobs. This is about work hour. And so the question then goes back to yours, Emily, which is, are people doing this voluntarily? Is it the person who's been working because they have a chronic condition, they need to get health care through their job, and they've kept working, they're 68 years old or whatever, and now they can pull back a little bit? Or the two-parent family where the one parent gets to now spend more time with their kids than they did working so that they could get health care. So there are lots of ways you could imagine that working. The question is, how big is the group of people for whom the decisions will not be voluntary? The reason this happens is the subsidy you get as a part of the exchange if you're a low-income worker goes away the more money you earn. And so when you earn that marginal dollar, your subsidy goes down, so it becomes a kind of tax. How many people would like to work more, but they're not, because if they do, they'll lose the subsidy, so that extra hour of work really isn't worth it to them. And so then the question is, well, what's the societal downside of that? Does it create a condition in which people lose their motivation? Do they not get access to promotion? If they're not working that hour and they're not getting the dollar in the pocket, are they then not spending it? The problem with all of this is it's incredibly difficult to predict all of that and how the behavior will bounce out over the term we're talking about here, which is 2017 to 2024, which is just so far away, we may all be, you know, speaking Greek by then.
I mean, also, John, isn't this true of every means-tested government program, that there's always some moment where you qualify or don't? There's a line you cross.
Right.
And then if you cross it, your choices, what makes sense, what choice makes rational economic sense, changes.
Right. And you're willing, in some cases, to bump up against that negative outcome because you get all kinds of good outcomes, which is job lock, and the idea that people are imprisoned in a job is not a good thing. So the question is, which are you getting more of? Are you releasing people from job lock, which is a good thing, or are you creating a disincentive for work, which can be a bad thing? And we don't know.
I want to make 2 points. One is, John Chait of New York Magazine had a very nice, I thought experiment, which was, imagine that we had universal health care and then all of a sudden we changed universal health care. We took it away and said, now you can only get health care if it's associated with a job, which would compel millions of Americans to be forced into the labor market to get work. No one would say that people being forced into the labor market to get work under those circumstances was somehow a positive good. So similarly, in a situation like this, we shouldn't say this is a positive evil. I thought that was a very clever thought experiment. The other point I want to make is, I think why the Republican criticism or the Republican excitation over this is effective is that it does get at something which genuinely is a social problem in America, which is that labor force participation is dropping at a very alarming rate. It used to be, I think, probably in the 70s. It was very recently at 66. It's dropped to 63%. So 63% of people who could be in the working are working. And that's a kind of an alarming number because work is really important. Work is definitional for people. Having people doing jobs is it's role models for children. It obviously creates the productivity that the economy needs. It gives people meaning and pride. And when you have societies where fewer and fewer people work, those societies tend towards unfortunate outcomes. And you've seen this in parts of Europe where unemployment rates stay very high and you get pathologies in these high unemployment groups that you don't want. So I think Republicans are wrong on the substance of it, but there is a legitimate reason to be concerned about what happens when people stop working. They're wrong on the substance of the CBO, of saying that this is taking
That's a crucial distinction, and I'm so glad you made it. I don't mean just in this little correction, but I think you're right about – and it's also a much more interesting experiment is the one you're talking about, Dave. It's like what are these other effects that will happen?
But there are also other things we could do to tweak the whole picture. I mean, if we raise the age for receiving Social Security, we would push people into work who are older in the way that this may push them out, right? It's not like this is a – fixed universe in which none of the other
that would be awesome if Obama announced that, like, you know, to make up for those 2.5 million, we're going to raise
people
Social Security.
Work later.
That's totally a good idea, though. You laugh, but we should be doing that anyway. This is a good reason to do that.
So, can I make a political point, which I think I believe, especially since I wrote it? Two things that interest me. One is that in the original mischaracterization of the report, I was having a moment, and I still have this moment often, where I think, like, the mischaracterization, both willful mischaracterization and also some who kind of misread the report, created a situation where people thought really there were 2.5 million jobs that were going to be lost. I think that's actually now pretty well been corrected, and Paul Ryan certainly helped with that. So a lot of people who wrote like this goes right into the Republican talking points about that kind of coverage didn't interest me. What did strike me, and I think is true, is this, which is that when a report comes out like this, it reminds people that this healthcare program is a big thing that causes shifts in the economy that are unpredictable. The CBO report was notable because it was a 3 times larger assessment of this work effect than they produced just a short while ago. I think it's an advertisement for the disruption of this law, the intended, in many cases, disruption. That sense of disruption and change and chaos makes people nervous.
Right.
Even people who won't be affected by – and the people we're talking about who will be affected by all this are low-income workers who probably aren't going to be voting in the off-year election. And if they ever are going to vote, they may very well vote for a Democrat. But I think the ones that Republicans have available to them are the nervous people who already have health care insurance, who have forever been worried that this law will muck up what they already have.
Right. This phenomenon of loss aversion, that people are very – worried about losing things, even things which aren't very good and could be replaced by something much better. They value – if I told you, John, I'm going to take that pen from you, you would value that pen as much more than it's actually worth because you feel it's yours.
Can we just say there was actually some good news in that CBO report? I mean, it doesn't look like Obamacare has failed to sign up a single soul, where the projections were – under the original estimates, both for Medicaid and for the exchanges, but not by some huge number. It was like 1 million each. Lots of people are signing up, and it looks like the awful death spiral problem of the wrong people and, you know, terrible risk pools. At least there's no evidence that's what's happening so far.
But would they have found that evidence?
Yeah, it feels like these numbers
maybe
are very
don't know
super,
the
duper preliminary.
Like but the more people who sign up, the less likely it is that you have that problem.
I think if you're a proponent of the Affordable Care Act, the two good pieces of news is that it showed apparently that people weren't being forced into part-time work by their employers who were trying to get around the strictures of the ACA. Now, that there may be reasons for that, but we're not going to get into it. And the other thing was that the CBO counted, I think, an $8 billion inflow, so monies into the Treasury, from these things called risk corridors, which are...
Yes, as opposed to, deficit reduction as opposed to...
It reminds me, we're going to have to take you guys down to 19 hours a week. Yeah. Is that a problem?
Oh, my God, please. Can I be the first to volunteer for that? 19 sounds perfect.
Yeah.
You can have my health insurance.
That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts right now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, we're cavelling, we're beside ourselves. We have the glorious Roseanne Cash in studio to talk to us about her new album, The River and the Thread. When the master calls the roll. But before we begin our discussion with Ms. Cash, we have to start on a down note, unfortunately. We'll be discussing the truly horrible loss of the great Philip Seymour Hoffman to a drug overdose. Joining me is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And, of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hello, Steve.
To talk about his legacy, we're joined by Jason Zinnemann, who covers comedy and theater for The New York Times. Jason, one reason we had you in, of course, is that Philip Seymour Hoffman was great in film. He was great on stage as well, and presumably you've seen some of those performances. Pause one second. I'm going to start with Dana. Dana, there's no way to measure this, and yet I'm confident in saying the sense of the collective punch of the gut with this one is almost overwhelming, right?
Yeah, I mean, to the extent that this seems like a hard segment to do, because there's at once so much to say about Philip Seymour Hoffman and his career on stage, his career on film, you know, his beginnings as a director. I mean, he's just so clearly an artist at the height of his career that to try to sum up his legacy right now just feels so wrong. It's like what if Shakespeare had died in 1593? You know, what plays would not have been written? It feels different than, much different than an artist who's at the end of his career and who you can talk about their accomplishments. And also different from someone like Heath Ledger, you know, a very young person whose kind of potential was taken away before they could begin to realize it. It really feels like this was one of our great creative forces who's disappeared. And so in a way, there's sort of nothing to say.
And the blow was like palpable. I feel like walking around the streets of the city on Sunday as the, you know, the New York Times news alert was popping up on people's phones, it was like you could see just a collective mounting woe as people were realizing it, and you could overhear people talking about it and sort of stunned. I mean, it landed with force.
And with great shock. I mean, I think it's not something that people associate with Philip Seymour Hoffman, right? This kind of biography of the damaged, addicted artist. Although he did have that in his past, he was so high functioning, right? He was so prolific and creative that we don't perceive him as somebody who is in any danger of disappearing in that way.
Philip Seymour Hoffman is productive on so many levels. I mean, he had this huge film biography and probably the greatest stage actor of his generation, but he also had a huge theater directing career. I mean, thinking back over all the times I've seen him, he's just so much a part of the firmament. Every season, he'd have a few things that you'd look forward to. I sort of started my career covering theater about the same time that he made his first big splash. And, you know, I don't think there's any actor I can imagine who made me cry more in the theater than Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Can you cite a role in a particular play you saw him in that blew you away?
Oh, so many. I mean, actually, it's in, I was thinking in 2004, Time Out asked me and David Cody to come up with who the greatest theater actor is alive. And it was down to Liev Schreiber, Jeffrey Wright, and Philip Seymour Hoffman, and we had a big argument over who would win. And we ended up choosing Hoffman. This is in 2004. And I remember one of the main reasons was just his sheer ambition. You know, here was a guy who was on Broadway three times, Long Day's Journey to Tonight, Death of a Salesman, which are, you know, most people think the two greatest American plays, and True West, which could be considered in that group. I mean, he certainly made the case for it. And so I would say, you know, True West, which he didn't just step into the shoes of John Malkovich and Gary Sinise, who really defined that role. And one thing I was thinking about a lot of his roles, he wasn't an actor who needed to be loved. He didn't pander to the audience at all. But he was wonderful at playing parts, playing people who want to be seen, Willie Loman, who want approval and are struggling to get it.
Well, we can't, of course, listen to any clips from those theater performances, but we can listen to some performances from his movie career. Dana, why don't you pick one?
Well, since we were just talking about comedy, and I completely agree, he can be very, very funny, even in roles that aren't necessarily written to be funny. I think we should listen to something funny. Maybe the Charlie Wilson's War scene where he goes off on John Slattery.
Okay. I know it was difficult for you to come in here hat in hand. That's not the kind of upbringing, I guess is the word I'm looking for. It's not the kind of man you are. I understand that. I'm not looking to humiliate you or exact a price in any way, so why don't you just apologize? We'll call it water under the dam, and we'll go about our business.
Excuse me, what the f***?
What?
What the f*** are you talking about?
Claire George said you were coming in here to apologize.
No, I'm supposed to come in here so you could apologize to me.
According to whom?
Claire George.
You told me to go f*** myself. I'm supposed to apologize to you?
Also, water goes over a dam and under a bridge, you poncy schoolboy.
Clearly, there's been a miscommunication between Claire George and somebody.
I mean, there you hear him doing something that, you know, we don't necessarily associate with the classic Philip Seymour Hoffman role. He's an alpha male, and he completely owns it. He does something similar in Moneyball, where he plays the very old school manager of the Oakland A's, right? And he finds this masculinity in himself. And there's where you see that he was actually a jock in high school, something I didn't know about him, that he was a big wrestler and baseball player. You know, so he could find so many of those different notes votes within himself.
One thing that a couple of the remembrances have focused on that I think is maybe the most miraculous thing about his acting is what a chameleon he was. Somebody compared him, I think, to Christian Bale, who, you know, adds 50 pounds for American Hustle and drops 40 pounds for, you know, something else. And there are these kind of acts of actual physical carving and sculpting that go into roles. I mean, but somehow Philip Seymour Hoffman seems physically to be a different shape. I mean, he's like a shapeshifter in these different roles. He carries himself so differently. And, you know, he's not... I mean, I think Belushi is an interesting comparison. It's a slightly heavier man who carries himself with such lightness that he seems to be able to put himself in any sort of physical vessel. Just to get a sense of his range, should we also listen to a clip from his Oscar-winning performances, Truman Capote and Capote?
Sure. I was writing the script as they were filming all that time in Italy, and I worked like mad all day long and then dashed down to the bar around midnight to end in the next day's scenes. And Humphrey had just about moved into the hotel bar.
Humphrey Bogart.
Where he and John.
John Huston.
And, they drank every night. And I mean drank, you know, like famished water buffaloes.
The first thing I remember, I think it was a shock when Philip Seymour Hoffman was cast in this. No one, he doesn't look like, he doesn't sound like it. And you see the transformation is amazing. He had this capacity to change the whole tone of a scene in an instant.
Right. You almost see, I mean, in that scene, right, he's playing a captivating storyteller. And so he's a captivating performer performing that captivatingness. And you can just hear it and you can hear how everybody's hanging off of his word. I mean, I think part of why this landed so hard is that thing you pointed to, Dana, about the mystery of how someone so high functioning could be wrestling with such dark demons. I mean, I think that's part of why there's such a sense of woe and shock, because it seems like if someone with that much deftness and that much potency can be unstrung in this way, that anybody could. I think it makes everybody feel vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. And at the same time, though, it becomes really evident that the level of emotional permeability that permitted performances like that, you know, must have been a very difficult burden to carry, which he essentially alluded to, you know, in mm-hmm. a veiled way in interviews again and again. I mean, you can actually see even in the roles he chose some sort of trajectory toward what eventually happened. But, you know, we were so caught up in the beauty of what he was making, you know, that we weren't thinking about that. I mean, this is what really struck me obsessively watching clips of his performances over the last couple of days, is just the degree of artistry he brought to everything he did, you know, to playing the nerd in Twister, the weather geek that I mentioned in my obit. That was where I first saw him, on a plane watching Twister and saying, who is that hilarious fat blonde guy in the supporting role? He stole the entire movie.
This is not one of his best movies, but I remember going to see Mission Impossible 3 just because Philip Seymour Hoffman was in it. And, you know, you've seen these kind of supervillain played so many times. And there was something about his character which was unlike any other supervillain I've seen before. There wasn't an ounce of sort of cackling charm to it. And there was something, there was a weariness that he has in a lot of his roles that he made sound evil and sinister in a way that I think that one thing about Hoffman is he doesn't fit neatly into that dichotomy of there's the kind of actors who are completely chameleons and they're actors who bring a bit of themselves to each. They're star actors. He was a little bit of both. Even in things where he's totally transforming himself, I still think that, you know, he had a certain recognizable Philip Seymour Hoffman-ness.
There's one more thing I wanted to talk about before you have to go, Jason, which is his power as a collaborator and what a collaborative artist he was, right? I think all of his best work was really done with people that he had known for many years and worked with for many years. Obviously, Paul Thomas Anderson was just beginning to create this amazing body of work with him. One thing that struck me so sadly is that The Master is the only time that Philip Seymour Hoffman will headline a Paul Thomas Anderson movie, right? Mm. He'd always played supporting roles before that. And Anderson has said, well, one of the reasons I made this movie and created this project is I wanted to work with Phil from the ground up. I wanted to build something from the ground up. And they built The Master, which is an unbelievable, to me, an incredible achievement. So the idea that there were more masters, there were more things of that degree of artistry that could have been made that won't be made is just heartbreaking.
All right. Well, it's especially hard to end this discussion, but we have to end it here. Jason, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us about the legacy of the great Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Good to be here.
Coming up, a rollicking discussion with the wonderful Roseanne Cash. You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for the things we mention on the program, we collect them on our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please, if you would, leave a comment while you're there. Go ahead, do it. Tell us what you think of us. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. Okay, moving on. Here we go. In 2008, Arkansas State University called up Roseanne Cash and asked her about restoring her father's childhood home. For those of you born under a rock and still living there, Roseanne Cash is Johnny Cash's daughter. The idea appealed to her in its own right, but it also bore unexpected fruit. While working on the project, she decided to take a road trip through the South, visiting personal and ancestral places, including Memphis, the city of her birth. From these journeys came the inspiration for her new album, The River and the Thread. Roseanne Cash has won Grammys, she's had number one hits, she's authored an acclaimed memoir, and she's seen her fiction and nonfiction enviably published in The Times, The Oxford American, various other places. You've lapped me so many times in life, it's amazing. I love that even in my own pursuit, you've done little pirouettes around me. But anyway, Roseanne Cash, it must be admitted up front, we're kind of amazed to have you on our show. Well, welcome.
Oh my gosh, I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
Thanks. Let me drag you right down. Right away down to our level.
You don't have to be so self-deprecating.
yes, he does.
But I do. Once you take away the self-deprecation, there is nothing left. Okay, a river is that which you can never step into twice, and a thread is that which runs through connecting everything. So am I onto something about the title of this record, that it's about this kind of interesting antithesis, is about going back to the South and finding both continuity and discontinuity?
You're spot on. And also other parts of that puzzle, which are that it's literal as well as the metaphorical, that the Mississippi River kind of flanks the area I'm talking about in the Delta. And oddly enough, my grandmother's middle name is Rivers, so there's even another ancestral layer to that. And the thread, as you said, that connects all of us and connects you to your past, but also literally, you know, I have a friend in Florence, Alabama, who was teaching me to sew during these trips I took down south, and she said, you have to love the thread. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a chilling moment for me. But the time travel sense that you just alluded to was huge for me, you know, going back to where I was born and my dad's ancestry, and then, of course, the Delta blues.
Mm-hmm. It's, I mean, it's the album is such an album, right? We live in the age of Spotify and YouTube and, you know, one song at a time. But this is a record. It's conceived as a record. Is that typically how you work? Do you work with a sense of a unified single project? Where do you sort of write songs as you go, and then you discover you've got 11 that you want to put out in the public realm?
I like albums that are themed, even loosely themed. Like my record Interiors was kind of dark, and it was loosely and themed about that kind of stuff. But this is, I would say, an old-fashioned concept album.
Yeah.
You know, it really is. And I love that. I was kind of writing some songs before John, my producer and husband and everything, conceptualized this idea on some of these trips down south. And I was writing a few songs before that that weren't connected. And he said, you know, I'm not interested in making a record with you of just your next 11 songs. Mm-hmm. And then the pennies started to drop about the South and what a rich minefield. It was both. It was rich and it was a minefield.
It's a very odd place.
Yeah.
Well, I could talk to you forever about the South. We'll double back to it, I hope. But first, you know, you love all your kids the same amount but in different ways, right? So I'm going to force you to pick maybe one song for us to listen to first off of the record.
Okay, I won't make any correlation between this one and one of my kids, but this is A Feather's Not a Bird, and I'm choosing it because it lays out the landscape of the record. There's an urgent journey in this, and I'm in it, and yet it's also a third person. So I'm going down to Florence just to learn to love the thread. The feather's not a bird, the rain is not the sea, a stone is not a mountain, but a river runs through me.
Roseanne, I wanted to ask you about the process of collaborating with John Leventhal, your husband and producer and guitarist and co-songwriter, and specifically that I read somewhere that you said he wrote most of the music on this album and you wrote most of the lyrics, but you had these very precise percentages that cracked me up, that he wrote 98% of the music and you wrote 95% of the lyrics, and it was just really obvious from the, you know, precision of those percentages that it was a very enmeshed composition process. And I'm just fascinated always by couples who can create something together, you know, by Cassavetes and Jenna Rollins, or, you know, people that are really engaged in a collaborative process with the person that they love. And I wondered if you had any stories about that.
Well, he does bring out the best in me, and sometimes it's not fun. You know, he can be really pushy and bossy. But the challenges he throws down, they've made me a better songwriter, and they made me a better singer, too. And he's a more visionary. I tend to put one foot in front of the other. And he conceptualizes, and he hears voicings in music that I don't hear. He gets concepts that I don't see until he starts bringing it to life, kind of magically. And he did conceptualize this record, and then I could start bringing my parts of the puzzle to it. I mean, basically, he wrote the music and I wrote the lyrics, but we would get into each other's business and complain. I don't like that melody, you know. He says, I don't like that lyric. But you learn when to stand your ground, you know. You figure out how important it is to you and stand your ground with it. So it was not an easy process to make this record, but it was so satisfying in the end. I read somebody said, this is the sound of a marriage, this record. And I agree with that. And I said to him, your picture should be on the cover, too.
He took the picture on the cover, right.
And he said, nah, just stick a little one inside. It's fine. But it's helped us work out problems in our relationship, you know. And we had to learn how to work in the studio together, not to take everything personally. If he said I sang a note flat, to think that it meant he didn't love me anymore. But there's a beautiful thing about seeing someone's essence when they're doing what they love most and who they are.
You know, as you were answering that, I was realizing that there are a lot of songs about marriage. I mean, in some ways, it is an album about marriage, really specifically, thematically, right? Edda's Song, is that what it's called?
The Edda's
story
tune,
of
yeah.
Edda's Tune about the old married couple who are friends of your family.
Yeah.
And When the Master Calls the Roll, which is a song I hope we'll listen to a clip of, which is about a marriage during the Civil War that's broken up by the husband going away.
Should we listen to that now and talk a little
bit
about it?
Let's listen to a clip.
Oh, my darling Mary Ann, the march to war is calling. Somewhere far across these southern lands are bands of brothers falling. My tender bride, the tides demand that I leave you with your mother, with my father's right.
Yeah, I love that song in particular. I mean, the album has been so great to have playing as the soundtrack of my life for the last week, but this song particularly resonates, and I'm curious about the story of it. I mean, it's a history song. Mm-hmm. In some ways, it's a song, it sounds like, about an arranged marriage, which feels like it has almost modern resonances with online dating ads, and it's a song that seems to talk through time.
Yeah, there's definitely time travel in this song, and, you know, it's about my real ancestors. My son was doing a project on the Civil War in eighth grade, and I said, you have ancestors on both sides, Confederate and Union. And I went on the Civil War database, and there was a picture of my ancestor, William Cash. Huh. And I got obsessed with him, and I found another ancestor, Mary Ann Cash, and I put them together in this song. I wrote the lyrics with Rodney Crowell, who's my ex-husband. And my husband, John, wrote the music. And this song has so much for me. I always wanted to write a narrative ballad in the tradition of those great Appalachian or Celtic narrative ballads, and even particularly war ballads. And I could never get it, never figure out how to do it. And the characters obsessed me when I was writing it. I woke up in the night thinking about them. And, You know, E.L. Doctorow said, writing a novel is like driving a car at night. You can only see as far as the headlights go, but you can get all the way home. Hmm. And I felt that about this song. I didn't know where he was from. I didn't know where it was headed. And the last four lines of the last verse came to me, just boom.
Oh, Virginia, whence I came, I'll see you when I'm younger. And I'll know you by your hills again, this time from 6 feet under.
I started crying, like, oh, he's from Virginia. Here's how he died. He's never going to get back to her. It was so sad to me.
I'm curious about your writing process, and also, you know, from what I've read, you were someone who grew up in a musical family but thought first about being a poet and didn't necessarily think of yourself as a songwriter. And I'm someone, you know, we're all word people here.
Yeah.
I'm someone who loves lyrics in songs and often hears the lyrics before I hear the music, before I hear how they come together. But I'm curious how the process of becoming a songwriter over the course of your life affects the way you think about lyrics and lyric writing and even how you listen to other lyricists' work.
Well, or listen to conversations or, you know, bits of imagery that evokes a phrase, you know, see something or you see a sign. I mean, it's always going on for me. It's not anything I have to think about. And I take notes on my phone about phrase. Somebody told me this Scottish aphorism, you ask me about my drinking, but you don't ask about my thirst. And that just hit me so hard. So I changed the line a little bit, and I put it in my song on this record, World of Strange Design. We talk about your drinking, but not about your thirst. And I figured if you steal that openly, it's okay.
It's an aphorism.
It's an aphorism. It's in public domain, right? And I stole something else from Shakespeare, and I figure it's Shakespeare, you know? You can steal from – everybody steals from Shakespeare.
And he stole constantly.
Well, of
himself,
course, so right? It's, he's the ultimate.
What goes around comes around.
Right. But my process is that I live it, you know? I don't. It's like you said, you're word people. You just live that. It's always there. You're always aware. And that's what resonates the most. I hear lyrics first, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, it should be said that our critic at Slate loved the record pretty much. I mean, everything I've read, it's been universally beloved. That's kind of an amazing thing, right? To put something out into the world and then have everyone kind of lick it all over like a little puppy. And it can't suck, right? I mean, that's kind of a nice thing to have happen.
It is a nice thing to have happen. And the great thing about it getting so much nice critical attention and even a little bit of sales, you know, I mean, not like in the 90s or something, but, you know, it's doing fine, is that I take it in. This is the first time in my life I've really taken it in. If anything was successful before, I would just torch it in my mind. Like, oh, that song was successful? Well, you know, and then I go through the lyrics. Oh, that could have been better. That wasn't quite right. Or I'd go through the mix or my vocal or something. Or I'd get anxious about the success of it. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not going to be able to handle this. I'm going to have to do something that really fails next.
Oh, you've hit this magic sweet spot, right, where you have enough agony left over to write achingly beautiful songs, but not so much that when they go to number one on Amazon, you can't. Please tell me you sat there clicking refresh on your Amazon ranking.
Of course I did.
Awesome.
Of course I did.
That's excellent.
But you just, you know, I can leave now because you pretty much defined it. I have enough agony left that I can still write, but I can actually take in something nice.
Roseanne Cash, would you stick around and endorse with us?
Of course.
That'd be excellent. I think we're going to go this way around the table. Dana, what do you got?
All right. Well, I had a beautiful, sad endorsement that was something wonderful that I read this week about Philip Seymour Hoffman, but I think that we will include it with the links on the show page of all the wonderful things that people have been writing and speaking about him in the last few days, because I want to do a happy endorsement because we have Roseanne in the studio, and I'm going to endorse Roseanne Cash's Twitter feed, which if you are on Twitter and you're not following Roseanne Cash, you are missing out on the delightful personality that you just witnessed here in the Slate studio. Her Twitter feed is just such a lively spot. I just feel like whatever you're reading, whatever you're listening to, whatever you're thinking about, whatever you're complaining about, we know about it on your Twitter feed. And your husband, Mr. L, who I know primarily as this silent presence in the background making wisecracks, it's great to hear him playing guitar on the album and get a sense of him as a person, because Mr. L is this awesome character you create, the little mobster, your 14-year-old son.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's great to follow the novel of your life through that medium.
Thank you.
That is excellent. I had heard that it was a great Twitter feed. Julia, what do you got?
I also have a endorsement inspired by our conversation with Roseanne today. I read an interview where you talked about the decision to work on this project about your father's childhood home, and you noted that he'd once said about that place, every rock means something to me. And it reminded me of a passage I read in this book I loved that I want to endorse. I just went and read the Alice Munro collection of short stories, Hate Ship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage. Roseanne, you're sighing.
I love that book. I love Alice Munro.
Well, that line of your father's reminded me of the story Nettles in Hate Ship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage, which is about, it starts with the story of a girl on a farm who sees it one way, and then a laborer's son comes and hangs out with her one summer, and he teaches her to see it another way. But this is, everybody who is not currently reading Alice Munro should put down whatever they're reading and read her instead. She's just so good.
Oh, I have to agree with you.
Here, here. Totally agree. All right, Roseanne, I'm psyched to hear what you have.
I have so many things running through my head right now that I love. The thing I'm going to choose is The Secret City, which is an organization in New York City that has this monthly, quote, service. It's structured like a church service, but it's secular. And Chris Wells heads it, and he gives this, quote, sermon every month that is so funny and wild and rambling. And so every month they have a dancer or a singer, somebody to bring food, somebody who shows their hand-stitched garments, you know, all of these different components that are set up like a church ritual but that are secular. And it's really for artists. It's a community of artists and kind of provides spiritual sustenance to artists in New York City, and it's open to everyone. It's fantastic. I love it.
I think we have identified the heaven that you're getting into.
That's it.
That's
Secret
it.
City.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dana, thank you so much.
Thanks, Stephen.
Julia, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, and you can also leave a comment there. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, SoundCloud, or in the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Mike Voilo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll talk to you next week. A mile or two from Memphis, and I finally made it home.